This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. Tickets are going very fast for the Unregistered Live event with Nick Gillespie and Dave Smith in Brooklyn on July 16th. We have a very intimate venue, and there are only a handful of seats left. So get your tickets now. Go to ThaddeusRussell.com for more information and to buy your tickets. Ever since I interviewed Katie Herzog for episode 74 of Unregistered, I've been waiting to talk to her again. This is my interview with Katie Herzog at the Renegade University in Seattle event, with a surprise appearance by someone who is very well known to Unregistered fans. This is my interview with Katie Herzog. So I'm back in Seattle, Washington, with Katie Herzog, staff writer for The Stranger. What is it, the only newspaper in Seattle, you call it?
It is. Yeah, I think it is, at this point, the only newspaper in Seattle. It's, everything else is folded. It's just us, once every 2 weeks.
Oh, they've actually folded.
No.
Here we go, joking already.
The tagline for the paper has been the only paper in Seattle for probably 20 years.
It's the only real paper.
Yes.
It's the only paper here doing real news.
I would say that's true.
Real journalism.
Yeah.
Real thinking.
Totally.
Challenging norms.
I don't think that the Seattle Times would agree with that.
Asking questions that no one else is asking. I think mostly that's you, but that's okay. So let me tell you a story, Katie.
Yeah.
Okay. So last time we met, you were on the show, and I have to admit to you, I didn't know anything about you. And it was kind of a desperation play. We were desperate for guests. We hadn't had an episode in a while. I'm telling the truth here,
I'm flattered.
You should. Someone said, you should go interview Katie Herzog. I said, where is she? Seattle, fine. I'll get in the car. I'll drive from Salem. I hadn't done any research on you. I knew you had some heterodox ideas about trans politics. That is really the extent of it, and that you work for The Stranger. So I get in my car. I'm driving up to Seattle. I'm trying to research you on my phone while I'm driving. Not safe, first of all. The first thing I find is your PBS, local PBS series on, essentially, as far as I could tell, how to recycle effectively. And I'm thinking, and I knew you were a lesbian, so I was thinking, environmentalist, lesbian in Seattle, this basically has no chance of going well. There's no chance that she and I, this person and I, are going to get along. So I kept watching you talk about ways to, you know, convert things into economic or ecologically sustainable stuff. I'm just getting deeper and deeper into a hole. I actually pulled over in Tacoma, halfway there, I was about to turn around. Then I found, it was weird, I found like a blog post by someone who had interviewed you or something, and all they said was, she's very gracious in person. She's a very kind person, very welcoming and warm. And I was like, okay, if she's not going to bite my head off, I'll go talk to the environmentalist lesbian in Seattle and see how things go. But as soon as I met you, there was a vibe. I felt like, oh my God, I can actually talk to this person. And she has a sense of humor, and she can talk about anything and is willing to talk about anything. And next thing you knew, you were one of my favorite guests ever and one of the most popular guests among fans as well. Like, fans of the show constantly talk about this episode, that episode that you were on, and I was really glad you did it. So there's the story of my conversion. It turns out I actually can like environmentalist lesbians in Seattle, or at least one.
God, that sounds terrible, doesn't it? Doesn't it? Your fans have been so nice. That's one of the striking things about being on your show, is that I think the positive, or the feedback that I've gotten has been entirely positive, which never, ever happens. Normally, I manage to piss off the left and the right, and, like, there's a small band of people who aren't mad at me. But in the case of your podcast, everybody is very nice. It's very odd.
Yeah, you said that right after the show. You said you got a lot of good love on Twitter, I think, right?
Yeah.
From fans, and you said, this is weird.
Yeah, I was like,
people like me.
Do you have a brain tumor? What's going on?
Well, so it's just so strange, right? I mean, everybody who's here, we're doing a live podcast in front of a crowd here in a brew pub, by the way. Postdoc Brewery, shout out, Seattle, and Redmond, actually. And, you know, everybody's nodding along because they're fans of yours, they've heard you. And it seems, when I met you, I didn't understand, actually, how you could have this much hate. I mean, I understand left-wing politics and identity politics and how mean and vicious it could be, sure. But also what you were doing, sort of calling, just simply calling into question these radical, you know, acts of bodily manipulation and calling into question why people should do it and getting such vicious, ferocious attacks.
Well, I mean, I did actually less than that. I mean, what I did was I wrote an article about people who detransitioned like 2 or 3 years ago. A lot of people didn't read it, but they decided that it was trash. And the article didn't even really question people's motives. It was just really a very straightforward story about people who detransition, which is a population that exists. But it's like, at this point, somebody recently started putting up stickers in the neighborhood where I work, the gay district of Seattle, that say Katie Herzog, and then there's this parenthetical staff writer at The Stranger, and then is transphobic, which I find that parenthetical very, very insulting. They have to explain who I am. Like, I'm famous enough to make stickers for, but not famous enough that you don't have to fucking explain who I am. Come on. Come on. Just say my name. Forget right. I make stickers. Just say my name.
You've had bumper stickers made.
They're not bumper stickers. They're stickers. Yeah,
right.
They got a little logo on
because
them.
Because you wouldn't want to put it on a fossil fuel consuming vehicle.
I wouldn't.
No, of course. That's right. You're an environmentalist
lesbian. Put it on a fucking Prius. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. Well, so you were actually run out of town, weren't you?
I did move. So I suppose technically, I mean, I didn't move because of this sort of like hate that's directed towards me. I moved because the cost of living in Seattle is too high. But it is really nice to like leave town and not have to worry about people calling me a TERF on, you know, my ferry ride home.
Just so people who don't know, TERF is...
A TERF is a trans-exclusionary radical feminist, which I'm actually not. I'm not even really, I'd say, a feminist at this point. You, certainly not a trans-exclusionary one.
You may not be any of those things,
yeah,
actually. Yeah,
yeah. But it's generally, you hear it mostly in sentences like, punch a TERF, kill a TERF, things like this. So it's really a term that's often directed at people with hostility.
Wow, like violent hostility.
Yes.
I didn't
yes.
know that.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
You can get T-shirts.
Punch a TERF,
punch a TERF,
kill a TERF.
It's like Nazi. It's just a word that has become...
And you've
become
been identified as a TERF repeatedly publicly.
Yes, and once you have been written into the book as a TERF, there's no right getting written out of the book as a TERF.
So you actually were walking around with the threat of violence.
I mean, people will email me threats every once in a while, but I don't take them seriously. I'm not worried about... There's a lot of talk about internet harassment, you know, and I do think that like... That's something we're talking about. I'm on the record as being against call-out culture, but I also personally don't take threats against me seriously because I live in Seattle and people are more likely to dive into the bushes when they see me coming than they are to actually come up and spit in my face.
Because they're actually cowards.
It's a very passive-aggressive city. It's one of its best qualities.
It's a very passive-aggressive city. Well, passive-aggressiveness is, I think, a hallmark of identity politics, right? I mean, that's part of it. It's sort of like, well, you make me very upset because of who you are, but I'm not exactly going to tell you why. I'm not exactly going to tell you what's making me upset, but just it's your identity. That's enough.
Right.
And I need you to act in certain ways, but I'm not really going to tell you the ways I need you to act. And if you don't act in certain ways, I'm going to be very upset with you.
Right. Well, it goes so far as, like, I think, like, are you following this thing that happened yesterday in Portland with Andy Ngo being... Did you follow this?
No, but I probably can guess.
Okay. So yeah. Andy Ngo, you know, I don't know if he actually is conservative, but he's a critic of the left.
Of Antifa in particular.
Yeah, yeah. He covers far left sort of social movements right. for Quillette and Wall Street Journal and NRO and other, you know, conservative outlets. And he just, some Antifa thugs beat the shit out of him yesterday. Shocking.
Oh,
shocking.
They really beat him up.
Oh, yeah. He was in the ER last night with a brain bleed. But there's also this was all totally predictable. Also, the Kickstarter that was started was totally predictable. So last time I looked, there was like $80,000 in less than 12 hours had been raised for Andy. So
wow.
he might come out on top, really.
Jesus.
Yeah.
So Yeah, what do you make of this, the Antifa, especially in Portland, where they take over streets and
I think it's
people?
Cosplay. I think it's LARPing. I think it's a bunch of fucking children who want an excuse to commit violence. And I think that's true on both sides of this debate. I loathe this. I think that especially taking over these cities, sort of turning Portland or wherever into your playground so that you can act out your fantasies of being in a gang or whatever it is. I find the whole thing, like, I think that some people probably think that they're, like, actually fighting Nazis. But in this case, like, Andy is a 5'5" gay journalist whose parents were Vietnamese refugees. He is not a fucking Nazi.
Right.
And you can tell yourself that you're, like, on the right side of history, but really what you're doing is beating up a member of the press because you don't like his views.
Right. That's correct. I'm not a huge fan of Andy, but...
Yeah, I think that... I have a lot of criticisms of Andy as well. I think he has a myopic sort of focus on this one thing.
Yeah, exactly.
But I also... I don't give a shit. Like, he's a journalist, and you
he's
don't
right
be
about
a
this.
Yes.
And you're right about this. Yes, this one particular issue. Yeah, of course. I mean, when they started blocking intersections in downtown Portland, I was living in Salem an hour away. Now, I don't know if this is my own Gangs of New York response to this, my own juvenile response, but of course, my first thought was, I want to go up there and beat the shit out of these kids in the streets, you know?
Yeah.
Because I don't think they can fight very well, for one thing.
Right.
You know? And I know a bunch of people, including myself, who can fight better than they can.
Well, they don't teach it in prep schools.
I know. My first thought was, let's go up there and actually, if they want to fight, I got plenty of people who can give it to them. I was so, so furious. They were threatening old people, like senior citizens, people in their 70s and 80s were just trying to get to their doctor's appointment. And one guy, they had to get out of the car and they threatened violence with him. Yeah, man.
It's also really counterproductive. Like that, I mean, that for me is part of the reason I loathe this so much, is because if you're actually trying to make a difference, or if you actually want to bring people onto your politics, this is the worst way to do it. Violent resistance isn't as effective as nonviolent resistance. So to me, it becomes, it's there's no principle involved here. This is just about conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's fun. Fighting is fun.
Mm-hmm. Right. Just like me. I know. That, right. I knew I was acting out my own juvenile. They caused me to want to act out
right.
my own juvenile impulses. They brought the kid out of me. But so... Now, here's the thing. You know this. Andy, doesn't really know this, I think, but they're a tiny, 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 tiny portion of the population.
Yeah, right? Super tiny.
Super tiny. They're just very loud and can be very obnoxious. The real problem, is it not, is that the mayor and the city government of Portland in particular have basically given them a green light
yes.
to do whatever they want. I mean, the cops actually have been told to stand down.
Right. Well, and I think part of the reason for this is because... Like, a story came out last year in the Oregonian, or maybe earlier this year, about that was sort of portrayed as, like, Portland cops, like, working with the Proud Boys, which isn't really true. Like, what happened is that the police chief was, like, texting with a member of the Proud Boys because that's what you do. It's like, and he was kind to him, which makes sense to me because, like, you're trying to de-escalate. You're using this person as a source. And the fact that this cop didn't tell this Proud Boy leader to go fuck himself was evidence that he's, like, on the side of the Proud Boys, which is not true.
Yeah.
They're trying to de-escalate a situation, I think.
The white savior complex is a powerful thing in Portland.
Yes.
I've never seen... I mean, and I've been around white saviors my whole life. I might even be one myself. But I have never seen it at such a psychotic level as in Portland, where... it's hard to even describe, but there is... There's a wearing of guilt that is part of the Portlandia costume.
Oh, yeah, it's real.
They really, really, and it's so, all of it's fantasy because there are no black people there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, is that why they're extra crazy about it?
You know, I think there's been some, like, solid research done on this. I was working on a piece recently about, for our Pride issue, I interviewed a man in his 60s who lived through the AIDS crisis, a gay man in his 60s, and we were talking a lot about this sort of generational amnesia, where the better things get, the worse people think that they are. And so I interviewed John Haidt and Steven Pinker just really briefly about, because both of them have written about this, and it is this very real phenomenon. I mean, things are objectively better for most people in the world right now.
Materially,
absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there is a, you know, I think there is a lot of existential angst and good reasons that people are maybe unhappy, but materially, we live longer, we're more likely to be literate, you know, people aren't, the maternal death rates are lower, like, things actually are better, but now microaggressions are a bigger problem. There are, macroaggressions have disappeared, so we're concentrating on the microaggressions.
These are the things that only, I say, rich people care about.
Yeah.
Can care about.
Yeah. Or like the NBA players who now, did you hear about this?
Mm-mm.
The owners of NBA basketball teams are no longer owners. They're now called governors.
Oh, right.
Because, right, you can't, Because it's offensive.
Because black people will always be slaves.
Right, but you're talking about the wealthiest, the most privileged population.
Yes, we must.
In America.
This is my friend Camille Foster. He goes crazy when LeBron James or somebody talks about white supremacy.
Yeah.
You know, from their multi-billion-dollar mansion in Beverly Hills, they're talking about white supremacy. Yeah. The wealth, you know, this all the politics that you critique all the time. I mean, I see it as rich kids. It's like a very well adorned sandbox that rich kids play in. These politics that you critique all the time,
mm-hmm.
I find it to be only the kinds of things that wealthy people can or do talk about. We just simply know this, that in the rest of the world they don't talk about this stuff at
all.
I'm pretty sure that's right, that in the Philippines they're not concerned about, you know, trans politics the way we
are. They're definitely not talking about what pronouns you're using. I don't think that they actually have
male
and female pronouns there, so especially that's not the issue.
And so for me, like, it gets really frustrating when there's other stuff going on that's really material, that's really scary and dangerous, you know, like, for instance, the existence of the United States military, right, and the existence of a commander-in-chief who has unilateral power over that whole thing, who can push a button and kill all of us in 5 minutes, right?
And who will. He'll sit on the button on accident.
And he might. Yeah. And think about the next person and the next
president.
He'll
just see a button. He just likes pushing
buttons. Yeah, he does. He does like pushing buttons. That's a good point there. Yikes, you made me more scared just then. So here's how the politics of the wealthy, I'm going to call it, the left-wing politics of the wealthy plays out there. What do they focus on? Do they talk about that? Do they talk about the power of the commander-in-chief and then, oh my God, Donald Trump has that power? No. They talk about what? His personality, his hair, his what he said about sex once, about a pussies once, what he says. It's his clothes, it's his hair, it's his skin, it's his lack of humility, his lack of, you know, modesty. It's all his person. It's characterological,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's all aesthetic as well. He's ugly. He's embarrassing to us.
All of these things are also true.
All true. Yeah. Fine. Sure. If you want. I mean, fine. But it's like, I don't care about it. All
right.
I care about is that he's got his finger very close to a button that could kill everybody. And yet no one seems to care about that. They do care about the immigration thing, as do I, but they didn't care when it was someone else doing exactly
right.
the same
stuff. Well, I mean, we're just captured by the news cycle. You know, it's whatever outrage is going, like, whatever image strikes us for today, and then we're going to forget about it next week, and there'll be a new one, and this just goes on and on and on for fucking ever.
So here's another thing that people don't know. After the interview last time, after the last time you were on the show, you and I were walking around Capitol Hill, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of was asking you, like, well, like, how did you, what's been going on in your head, you know? And you were like, well, when I came to the trans issue, I realized that the left was really, really wrong about a lot of it. And so since then, I've just been thinking, if the left was wrong about one thing, what else are they wrong about?
Mm-hmm.
Which was one of the most exciting things I've ever heard in my life, because that's basically what I've been doing for about 10 or 20 years now. And it's just been an incredible process of, basically for me, it's felt just like leaving a church.
Oh, yeah.
Just like leaving a church.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean everything in the church is bad or wrong, but I realize that, I'm sure just like you, there are just many, many things that are taken as articles of faith. Like, in a church, it would be the existence of God, or that certain moral rules are absolutely right. You don't even question it. You don't even bring it up at the dinner table as a question,
right.
because it's just assumed to be true. That's religious thinking. That's
right.
the definition of it. And I think what you immediately or very soon sort of picked up on was that there were a lot of things that simply were off the table in terms of questioning, right? That were religious thinking.
Right. And the existence of the patriarchy. It just exists in the air.
Yeah. And I think that that's where you and I kind of have share similar curiosity, in a sense. It's about, let's ask questions about the religious totems, the icons, the articles of faith, the things that can't be questioned, right?
Right. It's interesting you bring that up. I saw this on Twitter maybe yesterday or something. I saw as an example of, somebody was brought this up as an example of white supremacy, was questioning the existence of racism. So if you say to somebody, I want you to like tell me your experience, to parse this out, specifically what happened, specifically or what you're going through, that's seen as questioning someone's authentic experience, and that's racist in itself. If you demand evidence for the existence of something, that's evidence that in itself is problematic, which is like, I require evidence
mm-hmm.
for anything.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you're one of those scientists.
I'm not a scientist, but I do think that the scientific method has value. I mean, yeah. Not that science isn't also full of
okay. So that's
wrong
where
things,
that's where you and I might have some conflict. So we'll hold that to the end.
Okay.
We'll table that. So let's stay with where we're friendly. So you've been exploring the left with this new lens, this new critical skeptical lens, right? Since you discovered that they were really messed up on trans stuff. So, and racism, this idea, I guess, of systemic racism, you've also been questioning?
I don't even want to talk about racism.
Because you've been run out of one town already? Don't want to be run out of two
towns?
And
I also, it's like, it's not my area of expertise at all. I find Camille Foster and Coleman Hughes to be fascinating people. I also, like, I would love to hear a conversation between Coleman Hughes and Ta-Nehisi Coates on reparations. Like, I'm just not smart enough on this issue to know who's right, to know who's wrong. But I do think that I see a lot of the same sort of, like, shutting down of the conversation when you have, you know, heterodox thinkers like Camille or Coleman or, you know, Glenn Lowry, John McWhorter.
Right.
And I find them super fascinating, and I am very glad that they're bold and brave enough to speak against these sort of orthodox populations. But I also don't know enough about these issues to say whether I even think that they're correct or incorrect. And I'm also too smart to do that. I'm not going to fucking dip my toe into this.
Well, hold on now. But you must have some opinions. You must be leaning in certain directions. You must have some questions or at least skepticism about something now, having listened to those guys.
I definitely have some skepticism towards the, like, Robin DiAngelo school of thought.
I spell that out.
So she's the woman who, she actually teaches at the University of Washington, at least part-time.
I know this person, but most people don't.
So maybe you can do a better job explaining me. But she's the one who sort of coined the concept of white fragility.
Yeah.
There are other things, like this concept of implicit bias, or, you know, lots of organizations are doing, like, let's shut down Starbucks and do implicit bias training. Well, if you talk to the people who actually came up with these concepts, including this guy Tony Greenwald, who's a professor at University of Washington, implicit bias training is oftentimes counterproductive. It actually makes things worse. So to me, that's sort of where I question things, is like, is the practical application of this, does the data actually say, like, training people in this way is going to make this problem better, or is it going to make shit worse or do nothing? And just, like, actually looking at the empirical evidence.
Right. I've seen these studies where, like, firms that have hired diversity coordinators or directors actually have less diversity afterward.
And way higher overhead.
Right. Way higher overhead. That's right. A new salary, usually six-figure salary.
Yeah.
Okay, so they've at least caused you to question some of the applications of anti-racism.
Absolutely. Like, I would have, 3 years ago, if you had said, like, there's this, like, these brilliant, like, black conservatives who you should listen to, I would have been like, oh, like, Ben Carson, you fucking racist. You know, I would have totally written
And these guys aren't even conservatives.
They're none
of them.
Yeah.
They're either libertarians or liberals, actually.
Right.
Glenn is a liberal, and so is McWhorter. Coleman, I don't know how he identifies. Camille's a libertarian.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But they've caused you at least to open your mind and be skeptical of things.
Yes. And also, just, I'm also, like, incredibly impressed that, like, it's hard enough to talk against my own population, but race is a toll, like, a whole different, that's so hot.
More kryptonite.
Oh, yeah.
So, and all of this means that you're a Nazi and a racist, Katie.
Literally.
Because you've just even listened to them. No, I mean, this is how it works, right?
Yeah.
I call it the great conflation.
Mm-hmm.
Everything gets conflated. So, because so-and-so, let's say Coleman Hughes, has heterodox ideas about race, that means he is actually apologizing for racists, and racists are adjacent to the really bad people, the Nazis, and so basically Coleman Hughes is a Nazi, and so are you.
Or he's been on the Dave Rubin show, and Dave Rubin has interviewed Candace Owens, and Candace Owens has, you know, it's a very guilt by association.
I've been on the Rubin show.
Well, so, now it's two Nazis in a brewery.
Oh, for God's sake. Okay. Well, Heil Hitler, how are you? Finally, we can say it. Got that off my chest. I feel at home now. Oh, God, I was so uptight, so nervous. Now, thank you, sister. Is that what they call each other? I don't know. Do we allow lesbians? Wait a second. I don't know. Do we allow women even? Goodness. Yeah, no, it's tough out there. So what else have you been questioning of the orthodoxy, of the church? Are you still in the church? Are you still an environmentalist?
And yeah,
what does that mean,
I mean,
now?
It doesn't mean anything. I mean,
oh, good.
It means, I don't, like, my identity, I hate the fucking word identity in the first place.
Yeah.
I hate that it's,
me
like,
too.
Something I have to hear
Amen.
This word every day. I'm so sick of it. But anyway, my identity is not wrapped up in these sort of political labels anymore. So I've been in this process of decoupling myself from words that used to be meaningful to me. Feminist, environmentalist, lesbian, these things used to be, you know, wrap up how I thought of myself. And so I've been in this process of trying to, like, become less tribal, but also at the same time realizing that there are other ways in which humans need to be tribal. You know, like, tribalism is bad, I think, when it comes to big political issues. It's good when it comes to actually having real community. And I think one of the problems that, especially in contemporary American society, is a lack of tribalism in these ways, that we live in our houses, we don't know our neighbors, we don't spend time with our families.
I love that. And that's exactly what I'm trying to do with Renegade University and Unregistered, is sort of build a chosen family, essentially, right?
I fucking hate that term, I will say.
God damn it. Well, see, because I got it from you guys.
Well, exactly. That's why I hate it.
I take something nice from you, and you tell me I can't.
You appropriate it, and then you... I hate it when queers say it, too, because I just hate it because it's one of these terms I hear.
Why do you hate that? What's wrong with chosen family?
I just don't like buzzwords.
Oh, Jesus.
And it's just a buzzword.
Well, what do you want me to call it? Friends?
Friends.
It's too light. It's too light.
Clients.
Good friends? I mean, you're right. I mean, there is no such thing as, like, truly unconditional love, right? And that's what family is supposed to be about. There's no such thing as truly unconditional love.
Well, I mean, I think that family can be truly... I mean, moms still love their kids when they kill other people.
Oh, what if they come out as gay, though?
I mean, my parents didn't have a problem with it.
Your parents were hippies, though.
That's true. That's
your parents were, like, crunchy hippies in the mountains. Yeah, most parents, or many parents, when they find out just that their kids were gay, they sure as hell prove that unconditional love ain't a thing.
Yeah, but and then oftentimes it takes them a while and they get past it. I mean, there's also this, I think, in contemporary discourse, this idea that if your parents don't accept you right now, the moment that you tell them that you come out as gay or pansexual or kinky or whatever you decide to come out as, or a transhumanist or a dog or whatever, if they don't accept you immediately, then it's your obligation is to take them out of your life or take yourself out of their lives. And from my experience, I'm from the South. I've had a lot of friends and partners whose parents were not okay with it, and they oftentimes come around, and it takes a while, but like, if you've been indoctrinated to think that there's a hell and that your daughter or your son is going to go to it because of who they're attracted to, like, it's okay that this takes some time. It's cultish, but like...
Sure. I'm really interested in this chosen family. I'm sorry, what kind of... I don't know what to call it now. But I mean, it is. It's people who I have a special bond with beyond just friendship. It may not be unconditional. It may not be lifelong, but it's a special...
You can call them your chosen family.
Thank you.
I mean, actually, I appreciate it if you
can
do it.
Can you give me a certificate?
Yes. I speak for all queers.
Right. Stamp it with it. Give it the special lesbian stamp.
They've elected me.
That goes
in
the lower left corner.
Well, I am the last one left, so...
Are you?
Yeah.
Good. No, it goes back to what you're saying. Tribalism, right? Tribalism is a real problem when it goes beyond those you actually know in person. When your tribe includes people who are abstract human beings, when you claim as members of your tribe people generally or people you don't know, right? That's the real problem. But I think you're totally right that we do have a lack of tribalism or a desire for a particular kind of tribalism, which is what you're talking about, which is choosing people you want to be with rather than just settling for who you were born with.
Well, I don't know that it needs to be choosing people. I mean, I think that as much as family can be annoying and people's families can be terrible, I think that, you know, when people had multi-generational family situations, you could raise children better. Old people were cared for better. I think that there is actually something to these blood ties that are less tenuous than chosen family.
Oh, yeah?
You just like, yeah. Yes, I think you, you know, you do shit for, that's, I know you're not a huge fan of evolutionary psychology, but you do shit for people because you're blood related that you wouldn't.
So let me tell you this. So my father died 3 years ago. I didn't speak to him for the last 5 years of his life. I have not cried once. And I'm famously a big crier. I have not cried once about him.
Was he an asshole?
He was just sort of worthless.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't get anything from him.
Yeah.
And my brother and
I mean, you did get half your DNA from him.
Well, yeah, but I felt no obligation to take care of him, you know, or to be attached to him. Same with my brother. My brother and I are just so fundamentally different. We've never really had any kind of relationship. And certainly in many, many years, I mean, we don't talk at all. And it's fine. It's not a loss. I don't feel a loss. And I doubt if he does. So again, I'm calling into question your claim about the biological blood tie here.
Well, I mean, being meaningful. You're a data point, not the whole set.
Good point.
But I think that, like, if we lived in a way that allowed people to care for each other as opposed to all of us, like, we all have to go out and get jobs. We all have to find separate childcare, just in a way that was a little bit more collaborative. Not that I actually want this for my own life. I'm a fucking loner, and the fewer people around me, the better. So it's all very hypothetical. My desire to live in a commune with my relatives. If I like the like actually doing it sounds hellish.
Oh, wait, hold on now. So you're not practicing what you preach. In fact,
of course
you're not even interested in what you're preaching.
Of course not. I'm interested in this for other people.
Are you serious?
Yes. I mean, yes. Part of that is because I don't want children, though. But, like, I have a twin sister. She has two kids. She spends $30,000 a year on daycare. Mm-hmm. Not on college for these children. For daycare, so they can learn to, like, wipe themselves. And I don't think that their daycare teachers even tell them that. You know? Like, they're getting very little education on this. They don't know how to tie their fucking shoes.
Wait.
It's 30 grand a year.
Hold on.
Yeah.
I get that you don't want a family.
Right.
That's fine. I'm talking about, like, a tribe.
No, I would like to have a tribe.
Okay, good.
Yes.
Yes, that's what I want, too. I'm done having families.
Yeah.
I'm done having that kind of family.
You want a chosen family.
I want a chosen family.
No, I would like to have a stronger community.
There you go.
Yes.
I was going to say, especially you, given your recent experience in Seattle, right, where you kind of probably went there expecting to be welcomed, and you were for a while, until you had bad ideas.
Seattle is not the most welcoming city. I don't know many people get welcomed.
But you said
Seattle.
You were kind of part of, like, some radical lesbian anti-man clique or something.
Well, that was really before I moved to Seattle.
Oh,
that
okay.
was in my my 20s when I had, like, actual lots of friends.
Okay.
Seattle's not a town that people move to make friends. They move there for jobs.
Even when you were like a good Orthodox gay, they still weren't welcoming?
I don't know. I think that I've been in Seattle for 5 years. I think by the time I moved there 5 years ago, I sort of had immediate. Like, I was dating this woman when I first moved there who told me at one time that she told me in all seriousness that her friend of hers identified as a panda. And I just, like, couldn't fucking, like, keep my mouth shut about that. And like, when I couldn't keep my mouth shut, it was very clear that we had some differences in our values that were could not be overcome. Because I don't think that you can identify as a panda, but I don't think I should have to take you seriously if you identify as a panda.
What?
Or at least I think that I should be able to make fun of you if you identify as a panda.
Okay, I'm gonna push back a little bit.
Yeah.
We're getting laughter from the audience.
Go for it.
We're getting laughter from members of the audience who shouldn't be laughing because they're they're kind of panda adjacent at least. And they'll go unnamed, but they live in Seattle and might be a sex worker. Let me push back from a direction from a position I almost never take. Which is going to be the pro-panda side. So,
I like pandas.
Well, hang on.
I do like pandas.
I'm trying to straighten out your brain a little bit.
Okay.
I think you're doing well. I just wanted to perfect you.
Okay.
So you say that you don't take it seriously. So what does that mean? So this person identifies as a panda. They say they're a panda. Their body tells you they're not a panda, and
yeah.
so therefore you don't take it seriously.
Let's say I am not going to. I will use whatever your pronoun you want, but in my head, I'm going to realize that you're human. I'm not going to say, like, you think that you're a panda, and therefore you're a panda. I think reality exists. That I do.
Katie, listen. So before there were lesbians, see where I'm going?
No.
Yeah. Well,
there was no word for
it. It was said that if you were born with particular parts, it was just unnatural and really unreal for you to want to have sex with people of the same parts.
I cannot believe that you're comparing sexual orientation to the genuine belief that you are a panda bear, because it's not the same fucking thing. It's not. And like this, and you are like a Tumblr teen. Like, you are one of these people who is, like, confusing sexuality with all of this other identity bullshit.
Did you just call me a Tumblr teen?
You are a Tumblr teen.
I don't even know what that means, but I know it's bad. And I'm probably really stupid and uncool.
These people are cool. That's the problem.
Oh, I am
is that
cool.
It's just this, like, I mean, I'm sure you love this shit because it's all very postmodern and it, like, exists in this because your reality doesn't exist to people like you, but to people like me,
oh god,
where, like, you're human, like, I do believe in the binary. You can be a human or you can be a panda, but there's no merging of the two, not until we GMO human pandas at some point.
I don't even know if I want to have this argument anymore.
All right. You can concede that I've won.
I tried it with Joe Rogan. It didn't go well.
Yeah, I thought
that it would be easier with you. I'm just a little disappointed. But
I've spent a lot of time thinking about this panda situation. If you want to identify as like a pig or something, that's fine. But a panda just can't happen. They have like.
Oh, it's a pig. So you would allow for that?
At least the skin tone is a little bit closer.
What are you saying about me?
It's nice peachy skin tone.
Yeah. Okay. We have the same skin tone.
That
You're
is
speaking
true.
Speaking about yourself.
It's pig-like.
We're the pig people.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Write that down.
So, how about the Mariners? How are they doing? Anyway. What else are you questioning on the left? Or in politics? Or about yourself?
That's a
LGBTQ.
Good question.
Questioning.
You're questioning
a lot of things.
Yeah. I don't know. Let's see. What have I been writing about lately? You know, I think a lot about sort of free speech issues right now, and this weird position where we're in, where it's not the government cracking. Well, that's not necessarily true. There are what's the Republican who recently wanted to make some, like, regulate tech companies.
I mean, they all want to regulate tech companies.
This is like. Some Republican congressman wanted to, like, specifically regulate social media companies to make platforms more neutral.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been thinking a lot about that and sort of the conflation of free speech and the First Amendment. And also, I'm really worried right now. I'm really worried about the left. Did you see the Barry Weiss column the other day? And I just evoked the devil, according to, I'm sure.
Barry Weiss, New York Times.
So Barry wrote a column about this thing that's happening in San Francisco at this school. Some public school in San Francisco has a mural that was made by a 1930s communist.
I did see this George Washington.
This scene, this like very brutal scene of George Washington, like some slave. It was like a war scene. I don't actually know, but some very brutal scene that showed George Washington
from American history.
From American history, right? And it was painted in the 1930s. And the school board of San Francisco just voted. Six people just decided to not just cover this mural up, but to paint it over. So this is a almost 100-year-old mural that they're going to spend $600,000 to paint this over. Not because the students have complained, but because they think that the students feel unsafe. And so it's this whitewashing of history for this, like, safetyism. And I'm
safetyism? Did you just coin that?
No, John Haidt. That's a John Haidt word.
Oh,
yeah.
Too bad. I don't like him, but I like you. So, okay.
He's great.
Okay.
Mixed.
I like you better. Keep going. So $600,000 to literally whitewash this thing.
Yeah.
$600,000.
Yeah, and I'm worried about this shit, you know? Okay. And it's like we make these slippery slope arguments and then sort of hoping that the slippery slope isn't going to come to fruition, and it is coming to fruition.
I'm glad you brought up free speech. This has come to my attention too recently. I am very worried about this. I've posted this on Twitter. You've probably seen this recently. I think the First Amendment as a cultural norm, freedom of speech as a cultural norm, as the dominant cultural norm, is dead.
I agree with you.
That's a big deal.
And it's dead at the hands of the left. And like the right, it doesn't surprise me. The moral majority, we always knew that they wanted their censors pen on everything. But this is different. This is coming from the people who used to be libertines. And it's fucking disturbing.
I know. The ACLU, essentially.
The ACLU, which is also not even the ACLU anymore.
I
mean, they're spending more time regulating people's uses, regulating shit like the terms that we use for men and women than free speech right now.
Well, haven't they basically stated that they will no longer defend Nazis? They will no longer defend racists?
Right.
They will no longer...
Right.
That was the originating idea. That was the original idea of the ACLU, was that they would defend those who are on the margins, who are politically unacceptable, because they were a bunch of communists themselves.
Right.
And they knew that the next people who will get repressed are them,
right?
People like them. It's amazing they've lost sense of that. A core idea.
I would love to see somebody really report out what's going on with these organizations. My theory is that part of it is that young people are becoming older people now. So people in their 20s and 30s now have jobs in these organizations, and they're rising through the ranks. And sort of, I think a lot of this, like I hear rumors about, you know, these sort of bottom up, I don't know, coups in media organizations where, you know, Andrew Sullivan has said something that pisses people off, and so the young staffers at New York Mag or whatever all come together and try to get him fired and shit like that, which is like, it disturbs me to no end that you have young people trying to censor people because they don't like their their opinion.
And this is also, I think I was wrong recently about what's going on in colleges. For a while I was, you know, outraged by it, in part because I was a professor in those places and I was oppressed by the craziness there. But I would say to people, look, it's just a small faction, which is true. It's like 5% at most of the students and faculty do that kind of stuff. And most are sort of like you and me on this. But they're very loud, and here's the thing, they control the curriculum, though. Mm-hmm. They control the curriculum at those places, and they control the discourse and the speech that's allowed. I know this because I was in them for 25 years as a student and a professor. The thing is, and I'm sure you know this, I'm sure you agree with me on this, the problem is those kids graduated, and they're still graduating, and then what do? Because they're coming from Yale and Harvard and Columbia and Berkeley and Stanford, they don't become gas station attendants in Oregon. They go on to work in the media and right. in politics,
yeah,
and
yeah.
they have positions of power, just like you're talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, I mean, I spend way too much time on Twitter, for sure, and I know that Twitter is an absolutely skewed perspective of America, but it's also, you're seeing the people in America who have the most cultural power.
Yeah.
The people who are making news, the people who are in politics and law and in media. And so it is like all of this stuff gets filtered down into the rest of America. It's, you know, I do think that still if I walked into some bar in Nebraska and said like how many genders are there, most people would probably say two, but mm-hmm. this is like, and whatever, and I like, you know, and I actually don't have any problems with people coming up with their own made up gender shit, but it is spreading, and like the idea that it's not is just totally false.
So, you know, my thing, and I think you and I agree on this, is like, I don't done the trans thing, call yourself whatever you want, identify as whatever you want, and to me that's just as real, even if it's a panda, as anything else, sorry, but I do. And but the my problem, I think, is your problem, is when they try to enforce it and try to, and they expect us.
My problem is the conflation of sex and gender. That's my problem.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
This
is where we differ, but go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think that people, you can make up your own gender. You can, like, I might think it's ridiculous. Like, I've been trying to figure out, I keep seeing these terms like non-binary man or non-binary woman, which I'm so confused about, because if you're non-binary, isn't that opting out of the man-woman binary? It's very confusing to me. And then when I question it, people just say that I'm a TERF because I'm questioning this thing that I really don't fucking understand, because it's very confusing.
Right.
But still, whatever, like, people can make up whatever they want, but I still, the fact remains to me that there is male, there is female, there is intersex, and intersex people are male or female the vast majority of the time. And, like, so this, you'll often see, in the media, you'll see this conflation of sex with gender, which I think is, it's unscientific. It's illiberal.
Okay, I'm going to try this one more time.
And it's not going to work.
Then we'll drop.
You're not going to convince me that sex is a social construct.
Just because of the panda thing?
Because it's not true.
Your dick, this is my favorite line that I've got from someone else. Your dick is not your destiny.
Yeah, I don't think it is.
Okay, then we agree. So in other words, because you have a dick or a vagina or whatever part it is, means nothing except that you have a dick or a vagina.
Yeah, I mean, it means that, I mean, I think it goes to a more cellular level than that. We could talk about chromosomes.
Right, and so we find that, and by the way, not always do the chromosomes
right. I
match
mean, there's
the
like,
dick.
Right, but those are small exceptions to an otherwise like overwhelming majority that there is XO and there is XX and one is male and one is female. And like,
sure.
I mean, we talked about this last time I was on your show. The thing to me that this like, humans are animals, and it bothers me that people forget this so often, that we are mammals. There is no other, there are some species that are parthenogenic lizards and shit that change sex, but mammals are a classification, and we are mammals, and there are two sexes of mammals. And that's just like, it's just the way that the laws of nature here.
So what was it, David Foster Wallace? Is he the one who said, don't confuse the map with the terrain? Is that what his line was? So I think that's what's going on. For me, the classifications are maps.
Mm-hmm.
They're the classifications, mammal, cow, woman, whatever it is, are inventions. There's nothing wrong with that. It's a way for us to make a particular sense of the things that we see. We see things, right? The sensory perceptions come in through our eyeballs and our ears, and we get these points of light and points of sensory perceptions. And then we culturally piece them together and make shapes out of them. Some shapes are women and some shapes are cow. Then we call them those things. We put names on them and categories, and we say a cow is this, this, and this, and this. It has an udder, it has a tail, it has ears, it produces milk, et cetera, et cetera. A woman, see what I'm saying? Like, has these parts, and a woman...
well,
does this...
that's, I mean, well, now you're using the socially constructed term for female. I mean, there's, you can say that women wear lipstick. Well, that's not true. You can say women have, you know, that's why I find male and female very helpful. I mean, there's this trend now in media that you'll see, like, instead of using the term women or female, you'll see uterus haver or vagina haver for an article about tampons or whatever. You, which, by the way, you never fucking see prostate owner. It has never, ever, ever been written. Ball haver. Nobody, it's
ball
only
haver.
used... With females only. But it is this like, gonna, this nod to inclusivity that also...
So I'm doing a lot of online dating now. Uh-huh. I'm just going to identify my profile as ball haver.
Do it. Yeah. You would, you know what? Yeah.
Thad, 53, you know, enjoys red wine and long hikes on the beach and ball haver.
Yeah, that's what you are. Let's reduce people to their...
Apparently it just makes the panties drop, I got to say.
Oh,
just,
yeah, for sure.
They love you. And sorry, what were you saying?
Well, I think you should say balls haver instead of ball haver.
Oh, right. You don't want to scare them off with the... Yeah. They might. Well,
that's
probably
fine
a fetish
too.
For that.
I'm sure that it's fine to have one ball.
It's probably a whole porn subcategory for ball havers. Anyway, continue. You were defending science, I think.
Yeah, I'm in favor of science. I mean, I will say that most science, especially most social science, is vastly flawed. Many studies are not replicated, which is a problem in itself. But
okay, I got a question for you.
Yeah, go
okay.
for it.
So you think I'm a male?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that you are.
Because,
I'm not sure.
And I think we did talk about this last time, right? Because you assume that I have a penis or something. So tell me, what is it? What is it about me that's male? How do you know that I'm a male?
Well, looking at you now, you have a beard, you have chest hair. I mean, obviously that women can have these things, but I'm extrapolating from these sort of superficial characteristics.
Au contraire, they can.
Oh, no. Obviously they can.
Yeah.
I've just like taken pure averages here. Most males, chest hair, face hair, compared to women, it's just a different body type. I mean, I can see your... You know what I could do right now? I could feel the back of your head. There's this little bump that males have on the back of their skull called the occipital bump.
Oh, yeah?
Females don't have it.
Oh, yeah?
So they're just very... I mean, you could take... I could find your skeleton.
They're unlikely to have it, women. There's probably some women...
Well, are you talking about women or females?
I'm talking
about... You're conflating the two right now.
No. So you're saying that... You're agreeing that not all males, according to your classification, have... all of these characteristics.
Of course not.
Okay.
It's averages.
So then you're saying I probably have these things.
Yeah, but I'm also saying that you could take someone's skeleton and see and typify them based on their skeleton, on their bones. You don't have to have a flesh bag to be able to tell what sex somebody is.
Right, so there's this bag of characteristics.
Right.
Right, and we can call them male, or we can call them female, or we can call them donkey. We can call them anything.
Sure.
Can't we?
Sure.
So there's a set of characteristics, bump on the back of the head, Adam's apple, hair on the chest, whatever it is, right? And then we see those things, right? And we see them among certain numbers of people. And then we collectively said, that's what males are.
Well, I would say we did not. We were not there, but some people did.
I mean, there was a collective we at some point in time.
I mean, it depends on where you are.
And then it changed over time.
Right. Well,
right? And it changed many times over, right? So the definition of male, because chromosomes didn't exist because we didn't know they existed until recently.
I would say that early humanoids probably knew that there were these two things, and they were able to say, this one falls into this category. This is an innie and this is an outie. And then they put the innie and outie together, and then they have little innies and outies.
Except
that's like part of the necessity of... I mean, it is fine with me if like people stop like reproducing and all of this shit. If you want to just like human race be done with it.
Oh, you want to do away with the human race. I remember this about you.
I'm a member of the Church of the Voluntary Human Extinction.
Bit of a misanthrope.
Look, not a misanthrope necessarily. I just think that I prize Earth over human.
This is why I told you we would not get along. And environmentalist lesbians in Seattle tend not to like me. You still want to do away with all of us?
Like 90%.
This is why you like Sam Harris and those people, because they want to program us for human to...
No, I don't... No, I mean, I just think that there are... I think that humans have been a scourge upon the world.
Oh.
For sure.
Even Sam Harris wouldn't say that.
Always going to be some species that wrecks the ecosystem, and this is us. Or if not a species, then there'll be a meteor from Earth will end it all. I mean, I try to take the really long view of all this stuff, which is that none of it matters, because like the Earth will... I am worried about climate change. I am worried about pollution. I'm worried about air quality. I'm worried about water. But, like, really long view, none of this fucking matters, man. Mm. Like, the world will spring back whether we're here or not.
Does your life matter?
Not really. I mean, it does to the people who care about me, but we're not, all just little...
But not to you?
Yeah, I mean, of course it is to me, but big picture, it...
Okay.
I mean, I'm not like... I'm glad that I'm alive, but I don't think it's going to be a tragedy when I'm dead anymore,
except
for,
whether
like,
I should feel,
four people.
I don't know if I should envy you or pity you right now.
Both.
Because it sounds sort of liberating, but it also sounds sort of sad. What do you mean you're insignificant in the
you
world?
You are, too.
But is that... Sure, I... Well... Jesus, there's so much to unpack with you. You can choose to see it that way. You can see, I could get the argument. 8 billion people, and that's just people present, right?
Right.
If you take all of human history, how many billions is it? I don't even know, but it's a fuck ton of people.
Yeah.
And you're just one versus 80, 100 billion, whatever it's been, right? One place of the, one little part of this one globe, which is just one sphere. In a universe full of other spheres and objects flying around.
We're just a fucking speck of dust, man.
Tiny, super tiny, tiny. Well, that's all, here's the word, relative, though, right?
Yeah, of course.
So if you take the perspective of God, yes, right? The all-seeing God who knows that the universe is that big and there are this many people, right? Have that in mind, then yes, I am totally insignificant. That's a very outward, external way of thinking, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, my whole thing, and I was thought you were going there recently, is like, get away from politics. Get away from political thinking. That's godlike thinking is political thinking. Thinking of people in the abstract and 8 billion people who you don't know, that's just a number, right? Mm-hmm. It's not real people in your life. We're talking about tribes and tribalism, people who you actually know. I'm trying to direct my, and this is to myself, I was a political person, always worried about the people, doing things for the people I never would meet, right? And lately, and this is part of my chosen family project here, Renegade University, Unregistered Media, what I'm trying to do is build this community of people. It involves moving away from the external toward the internal. So that's both like self-work, like therapy, frankly, and, you know, meditation and whatever it is, you know, to sort of understand yourself and work on your issues first. Instead of letting those things just fester inside of you, and then when you see someone in the external world who might be president or a congressperson or like the heterodox lesbian in your neighborhood, then you just dump all that internal drama onto them. You project all this stuff in your own life that really should have been processed with a therapist or maybe through meditating or maybe through not drinking or something. Then it all, that's why politics becomes so vicious and nasty, I believe, mm-hmm. because people are just doing to you what has been done to them.
Alternate theory.
Okay, let's hear it.
I'm starting to think that therapy makes people worse. Mm.
Totally correct. In
okay.
certain cases.
Yeah, yeah.
Psychoanalysis.
Not cognitive behavioral therapy. Meditation apparently has a lot of value. But this sort of endless perseverating on your own problems, which I think a lot of people do.
I did for 10 years.
Yeah, it turns you internal in this way that makes your own problems, magnifies your problems. I think probably... a lot of people would get more out of fucking volunteering for somebody else than actually like paying somebody to talk about your problems.
I agree to a large extent. Yeah. I think some psychoanalysis is good. I wish I had done it for like a year or two instead of 10.
Yeah.
I would have saved a whole bunch of money. And also, more importantly, I would have saved a whole bunch of pain, suffering, misery, walking around the streets of New York City where I was living at the time, thinking about my mother when I was 7 years old, thinking about how terrible my childhood was, thinking I was uniquely damaged, thinking I had a uniquely difficult childhood. Thank God I did something known as growing up, which was I just got over that and started to pay attention to other people's lives and other people's childhoods. And once I started doing this podcast in particular, right, where everybody's got an incredible story of at least as difficult a childhood or something that they went through that was at least as hard as what I've gone through. Thank God for that.
Have you read Johann Hari?
No, but I've heard
about
it.
Oh, my God. I've been reading his book and everything.
Humans?
This one is... Fuck. I actually don't know what
it's called.
Yeah,
I'm
that's
definitely reading
called.
It. He has a book
remember.
Called Humans, though, doesn't he?
This is not called Humans.
Okay.
This one is, it's his newest book, and it's about depression and anxiety. Mm. And so there's this narrative that, like, if I ask anybody on the street, like, what's the cause of depression, the most likely answer is going to be, like, oh, there's a chemical imbalance. It turns out there's no evidence that depression is linked with some, like, serotonin.
No shit.
No, there was, like, a couple of flawed studies in the 60s that had, like, 12 people in them.
This is just this narrative
that has just been, like, spun out so that everybody fucking believes it. And so, I mean, this obviously, like, you know, he's a journalist. His book could be wrong too. That's one of the problems when you start going down these rabbit holes. It's like, oh, well, this thing that I thought isn't true. Maybe the thing that's proving it wrong isn't true either. So I have no idea if he's right or not, but the book is fascinating, and it's more about the way that we live our lives and how the way that we live our lives contribute to things like depression and anxiety, and how it's like a lot of it, you know, is situational, and there are good reasons to be depressed and et cetera.
It sounds very...
And also the fact that SSRIs are no more effective than a placebo, placebos are effective, which is... That doesn't mean they're not effective, but it does mean that they're effective at a cost, which can be like weight gain, lack of sex drive, lots and lots of repercussions or side effects.
Yeah, what you just said, there's so much to unpack there.
You should have him on your show.
Totally, I would like to. Yeah. Many people have suggested it, but no, there's a lot there that needs to be unpacked. It's so fascinating. First of all, the placebo thing, the placebo effect. So I've had this malady for about 2 years now that I've gone to doctors to see, that was diagnosed as something that it definitely is not, that is very pretty clearly in the doctors by now and the physical therapist I visited, there's pretty much a consensus among them and me that it's entirely psychosomatic and having to do with stress.
Yeah.
But it has caused serious physical pain for about 2 years, pretty much chronic pain. But I noticed that the less stressed I would be, the less it would happen. When I was really not stressed, it wouldn't exist, etc. So that called into question, I started to examine and study a bit chronic pain, mm-hmm. And the sort of the current research on this. And I found that my condition, first of all, doctors just didn't know what to do with it. But it's an epidemic among men, apparently. It's called prostatitis, but you could have it without any prostate problems, which is like me. My prostate is totally normal. I have no cancer, nothing like that. But there's symptoms. There's a sort of collection of symptoms in the abdomen that a lot of men have, and they don't know why, and they're trying to figure it out, but they're pretty sure, at least in my case, that it's basically psychosomatic, having to do with stress and tension and anxiety. It's just I think a lot of men carry the tension they have in that part of their body, and then it causes all sorts of stuff.
In the prostates?
It's not even in the prostate.
Yeah.
It's just around that area. I mean, in my case, not at all. Like abdominal, pelvic, all over my abdomen. So that comes back to one of my big themes, the mind-body duality in Western thought, right? And so where it sounds like Western science, because of these new, and kind of what you're talking about, how placebos work, right? That's clearly an indication that the mind can either make the body feel bad or make it feel worse, feel better. Right?
For sure.
Yeah. It's just fascinating. So that kind of breaks down this whole mind-body duality, which is so central to our culture.
Yeah. I mean, the problem with placebos, at least when it comes to treating things like depression and anxiety, is that they can be really effective in the beginning, but they stop being effective. So you have to continue to increase the dose, and they also can have really terrible side effects. But it is, I mean, the power of thought. It's very wild that people can actually, you can make your own problems. You can cure your own illnesses.
And when I meditate, it's like I took Xanax. I mean, it feels almost exactly the same. When I meditate in the morning for 15 minutes, it's pretty much the same as if I took a Xanax in the morning. For the next many hours, I feel calmer, more relaxed, more serene.
How do you get over the absolute boredom?
It's about work.
Right.
It's work. It's practice. It's why they call it that. You know. And I just do Headspace, the most mainstream mindfulness meditation there is. But yeah, it's just, and I don't do it nearly enough, but when I do, I feel like I took a drug.
Yeah.
In a good way.
I mean, I love drugs, so I should really try it more.
Totally. But it's work. It's hard. You got to concentrate. You got to focus on letting those thoughts drift away like clouds, kind of like what you were saying. But yeah, it also points to, again, this thing that the mind and body ain't separate. They're really one and the same. If I have felt serious chronic pain where I couldn't sit for times, I was hurt when I was standing up, when I was just all kinds of ways, I was in pain. And now I know, is my mind doing it?
You fire your mind.
And then that's what I'm in the process of doing.
Yeah.
The mind is in the HR department office right now, being given his papers. And we're going to call security pretty soon and have him pack up his boxes. You
Get
know what
out.
I mean? One of those, and walk him out of the building. Trying to do that. And that's part of internal work, and it's part of finding a tribe that's also interested in doing that kind of work, rather than just projecting shit onto politics. So that's kind of the kind of tribe I want to be a part of, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean... Yeah. It sounds fun. I'll be in your tribe.
Yeah? Oh, yeah? You promise? Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. No one else will have me.
No one else? Is that why? You'll just take the leftovers. So Yeah, so where do you want to go next, politically or intellectually or personally? Do you have I keep asking you this, and I never get a clear answer, which is good.
I'm not much of a planner, to be honest with you. I would like to write a book at some point. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I have a very, like, nice life now. We just bought a house in a small town where I can hear sea lions from my house, and we have a really big view of the mountains, and, like, I walk to the ferry every day. It's really, really nice. So that's what I want. I want to just, like, continue to live my, like, nice, quiet life. But I also would like to write a book and, like, I don't know, be on more podcasts. I was thinking recently that actually the perfect job for me would be, like, a talking head on Fox News, which is the strangest. Or even on conservative radio, like being the liberal, the token liberal on, like, conservative radio, which I think would actually be good, because I think I can translate for the right. I think I can serve as a translator between the left and the right.
Do you like getting yelled at a lot?
I fucking hate it, actually, which is weird that I continue to put myself in this position.
So that's what's going to happen. So I've been on the Sean Hannity show. I've been on the Laura Ingraham show.
Yeah.
And all they did was yell at me.
I don't want to be on their shows. Oh. I want to have my own show.
That's what I want, too.
Yeah.
Your own show, but it would be for conservatives?
Yes. Because I think that conservatives and liberals we live in such different worlds that we literally cannot speak the same language. Like, I wrote something recently after the statewide abortion bans started coming down, and I wrote something about, my girlfriend happens to be here, but also happens to be from a religious family, and used to be religious, and so I have the unique position where I'm very close with somebody who can sort of explain to me, like, all right, if I say, when you were pro-life, what did you think about abortion? And she would say, I thought that abortion was murder. And so instead of saying, okay, you wanted to control women's bodies, which is what the left says, I say, I believe her. I have started believing people on the right when they say, I think abortion is murder, instead of saying, you hate women. I'm telling myself, no.
You don't question their motivation.
I've stopped questioning their motivation, because that's why, awesome. Like, who am I to say that this isn't what they believe? They're telling me what they believe. Why shouldn't I mean, and there could be all sorts of, like, internalized hatred of women, for sure. I think that can exist. Mm-hmm. But, and also there's lots of theological, reasons to think that especially Christians, don't think that women should have as much power as men. But when somebody says to you, I think abortion is murder, I've started to believe it. So, and on the same hand, like, if Christians think that liberals are trying to subvert the sanctity of marriage because they hate marriage, I feel like I can say, no, they actually like marriage. They want to take part. Like, they want gay people to take part in this thing because they believe in the sanctity of marriage, or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
So just, like, somebody who can translate between these two sides, I nominate myself.
I second.
Thank you. But every time I do this, people just stop, like, get just mad at me for attempting to serve this.
We will make this happen, as a matter of fact. Yeah, don't worry. We'll talk later. But no, seriously. So I love the idea of it's the questioning of the motivation.
Right.
That's the problem. That's the fundamental problem.
It happens on both sides.
Oh, yeah.
For sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But that is, you can't get anywhere if you question the other's motive. If you think that the motives are, if there's ulterior motives, or if they have some manipulative motives or something like that. And once you get rid of that, you can actually have a conversation. This what this podcast is really very much about, right? I mean, I have had conservatives on who believe that abortion is murder on this podcast several times. I've had...
And it's not helpful to say, like, no, you don't. You actually want to control women's bodies.
On this abortion question, I have had exactly the same... I've gone through exactly the same sort of pivot you have on this. Because I've been around them a lot lately through the podcast... I've realized, oh shit, it's not just what I believed, which was the feminist line. It's not just hatred of women and wanting to control women's bodies. They really do believe abortion is murder. And
it's a lot of women who are, like, women are as anti-abortion as men are.
I mean,
it's like 48 and 48.
Yeah.
Like, it's very, very close.
Sure.
I mean, and women are in legislatures that are voting for these laws. And unless we actually acknowledge that this is something that women believe, that this isn't, like, the patriarchy is not necessarily imposing these values on people, there's not going to be any way to like, go forward with this problem.
People talk about, the states like Mississippi and Texas, and, oh my God, we can't allow them to ban abortion, which they're essentially doing. And I say, well, ask the women in Mississippi, and you're going to find that a vast majority of them are not on your side.
And
sisters.
People of color also tend to be more religious.
Totally.
I mean, they're,
that's
like,
right.
We need to just when people say who they are, we need to believe them. I think it was like fucking, who was it who said that? It wasn't, I don't know.
Audience.
Yeah,
it was Maya, a panda.
It was Maya. It was Maya Angelou.
Maya panda.
And she's right.
Yeah, yeah. So so here's where I am on abortion. Like, I'm really an agnostic on this too. I'm officially as pro-choice as anyone could be, but I can't disprove that it's murder, nor can they prove that it's murder. So I'm just kind
of
like,
it depends on your definition of what.
Yeah,
of what
I just throw my hands up.
But
like, until they can prove that it's murder, I'm going to let it happen. I'm going to allow it.
I find one thing that I find really interesting about the abortion debate is that in places like, in like Asian countries, to places like China, like abortion is not only not a big deal. I mean, a lot of people are aborted,
mandated
right.
in some cases. Yeah.
But you know what is totally taboo there? Organ donation.
Hmm.
Because according to their sort of theology, your body lives in all parts of your body. So it is just this like very cultural, you know, like our taboos just seem arbitrary in this way.
What do you want to write a book about?
Well, I wanted to write a book about anxiety, specifically about driving anxiety. So I don't drive anymore for the most part because I like lost the ability to drive sometime in the past like 10 years. And all of the women in my family go through this. It's very strange. Like, starts out like got my license at 16. I've driven across the country several times. Didn't have any problems. And then I started getting like lots of anxiety when I would drive over bridges and then during rain and then like on freeways and then at night. And then so now I sort of hate driving entirely. And it's this like five women in my family no longer drive, and I have a big family, so it's not that many, but
wow. It
turns out that this is a really common thing and that there's ways to deal with this. And most of them are things like exposure therapy. But the problem with exposure therapy for driving is that like the more I do it, like if you're scared of being on an airplane, you're not going to wreck the plane. If you have a panic attack, if I'm driving and I have a panic attack, I'm going to kill somebody. So I want to write a book about that. And then I want to write a book about death.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
We're gonna have courses on death and dying. Yeah.
Yeah.
Really good.
Yeah.
What are you gonna write about death?
Well, I'm an atheist. I've always been an atheist, and I am concerned about death, my own and other people's. And so I want to write a book about sort of coming to terms with death and doing like trying out different spiritual traditions, maybe going and doing some MDMA in the desert somewhere or some shit like that. But doing things like going to ceremonies where people are dying, just talking about it. And so both books would be sort of journey books where I have a problem to solve and I'm going to fucking come to the bottom of this thing and I'm going to come to the bottom of the other thing.
The things that scare you the most.
Yeah.
Driving and death.
Right.
And they're obviously connected.
Same reasons.
So you're going to go at them by writing books about them.
Yeah. Yeah. Basically, I don't want to pay for therapy. I want somebody else to pay me.
I'm not making fun of you. I think that's really smart, actually.
Thank you.
Because you're going to have to work all the way through those problems. You're going to have to do a lot of exposure therapy and
right.
just to do the research, right?
Right.
Essentially.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, you can do things like there's VR exposure therapy,
which
I think would be interesting.
Yeah,
so that's what I want to do, and I've done very little to start the process, so we'll see whatever happens.
There's some I can't believe you're saying this, because some things I can't even say on air because we're going to launch them later and I got to keep them secret, but when you talk about virtual reality and death, I have some things to tell you.
All right.
Later, yeah, that will be pretty exciting, I think. But wow, that's cool. I didn't know these things, that you had these plans.
Well, these are
or
plan
ideas.
Plan
ideas.
would indicate that there's like some steps have been taken. I'm basically waiting for somebody to call me up and say we'll give you $500,000 to write a book.
Yeah,
that's the state.
They won't give you
waiting.
That, but they might give you.
That's what I want, though.
To go forward. Yeah.
That's what I want.
So that's great. I love that you're not just beating the trans horse more. You know, you're moving on to totally.
You
different...
just beat the trans horse. You are gonna get Chapo Trap House is gonna pull that out and put it online.
Beating
We're
the trans
both
horse.
Fucking dead now.
Take it, Chapo. You know I can beat you up. That's so cool. So I think it's time to take some questions.
Sure.
You ready?
Yeah.
Let's see what these people have to say, if anything. I don't know. Do you guys want to say anything? So Norm's here, and he has a question for both Katie and a member of the audience, Maggie McNeil.
Yes. So a question for both of you. You write. You're the only newspaper in Seattle. And you've been out in the media and everything, but being part of Thad's podcast and everything several times, I'm sure it's brought some positive attention, but I'm curious about it bringing possibly negative attention, because, I mean, this is what Thad's podcast is about. It's about questioning what's acceptable by the mainstream of the mainstream. What has that been like for both of you? What have been both the positive and negative ramifications of that been?
So I haven't gotten much negative feedback about Thad's podcast, and that might be because, in part, just because we're so siloed into our, you know, various media bubbles that the people who would drag me for being on this podcast aren't listening to this podcast. I do think about that, though. Like, there's a woman named Megan Murphy who is an actual TERF in Canada, and I disagree with Megan on a lot of positions, but I still was on her show, and I knew that was going to be a problem, and people, you know, sent me shitty emails about it, but I don't really give a shit. The other show that I haven't done, but I assume that I will at some point, and that I'll get shit for it, would be anything to deal with Colette. I think there's just a very knee-jerk negative reaction to Colette. I also happen to think that Jonathan Kay, who is the host of one of their podcasts, is a fantastic interviewer, and has these very good, complex, nuanced conversations with people that nobody ever listens to. They just say, like, oh, Jesse Signal was on the Colette podcast, therefore Jesse Signal's a Nazi, or whatever it's going to be. But this one has actually been totally fine.
Well, for me, I haven't gotten, well, basically ditto what Katie said at first. You know, for the most part, anybody who's listening to one of Thad podcasts is receptive, and that's fine. As far as the bigger picture, not just appearing on Thad's, but on all the different radio shows and TV shows and everything, I've been on so many different ones. I've been on ones that call themselves progressive. I've been on ones that call themselves conservative. I've been on ones that call, lots of ones that call themselves libertarian. I've been on general good current events type things that don't really take a specific. And I have been very fortunate, and I'm going to knock wood here because I'm just a tiny bit superstitious, but I honestly think one of the reasons that I don't ever get shit is that I scare the fuck out of people. I intimidate most people so much that, oh, they may be talking in their little cliques about, well, Maggie McNeil, you know, blah, 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 blah. But they don't dare say anything to me in public. And that includes the TERFs and SWERFs and all that bunch. And they just don't, because when they try it, they get shot down in flames and, you know, get humiliated in front of their peers, and so they don't try it anymore.
And now, do you have any more questions? Go for it, Nathan.
So, Katie, your notoriety or your infamy could be perceived as good for business in a way, in that people are going to want to pick up The Stranger and read, or go online and read the latest thing that Katie has to say. But I have to believe that it's had an effect on the way you choose stories or pitch stories to your editors. Do you think, first, is the perception of your controversy, notoriety, infamy, whatever you want to call it, do you think that's perceived as good for business? Do you think that's perceived as bad for business? And then how has it changed the way that you conceive, pursue, pitch the stories that you do?
So I actually have no idea if it's been good for business or bad for business, because I don't think about business at all. We have there's a firewall between sort of the business operations and between editorial. And so it's possible that advertisers are calling and saying, like, get that bitch off of your team. And that's possible that that's happening, and my bosses are dealing with it, and I don't know. They don't tell me. And I like, am glad, because I don't want the screams from the masses to be affecting what I care about, what I write. I think it's been good for my sort of personal profile. If I were taking the super woke line, I might have also been good for my profile. I mean, the people who've written for The Stranger who've been the most successful are like Lindy West and Ijeoma Luo, people who are like super woke left progressives, and they have much, much better careers than I do. So much bigger platforms. So I think that in some ways it's been good for me in terms of getting a bigger audience. because I'm one of fewer people criticizing the left from the left. But I also think that if I were just doing this for clicks, like, I would be writing about how dead people are problematic, and that would be better for my profile. I could have a column at Teen Vogue by now or some bullshit like that. But I'm really motivated to write based on my sort of personal frustrations with the world. So I try not to think too much about traffic, and I don't pay attention to it. I have no idea sort of where I fall in terms of like monthly views and stuff like that, because it's just not, it's not my business.
Cool. Anybody else? Any questions? Comments? Norm, follow up?
Yes, I've got another question. How has, for both of you, you know, you've I want to ask a question for both of you, because that gets very interesting people, you know, out there. Before you became a writer and an advocate, and before you got involved in your profession and became an advocate, how did your whole mindset change versus where you anticipated it being? So in other words, you know, there's conventional mindsets about, you know, I'm part of the LGBTQ community, so I'm going to fight against the oppressor, straight white man, what have you. Or I'm, you know, involved in the sex work community, I'm going to fight against, you know, laws and such that are, you know, prohibiting my line of work or making it more dangerous for me. What has changed unexpectedly for both of you since you've gotten involved in your professions?
So I've never thought of myself as an activist. And even before I was working for The Stranger, I wrote for an organization called GRIST, which is an activist organization, but for it's specifically around climate change. But for me, I'm a columnist and I'm a reporter. So I'm in sort of a weird middle ground, because my paper is not the sort of paper where we have a clear delineation between, you know, opinion and journalism or whatever. But what I'm not is an activist. So for me, even when I was working in that sort of environmental space, the most important reporting is always just what is about the truth. So, like, this wasn't me, but one of my colleagues at GRIST did a really big series on GMOs, which all of the science says GMOs are not harmful for people. There's lots of people want labels, they're suspicious for good reasons. Everybody's terrified of progress and corporations, and you just scream big pharma and people freak out and start thinking that their strawberries are giving them cancer or whatever. And so one of my colleagues, Nathaniel Johnson at GRIST, did like a 6-part series looking at the data behind GMOs. And I really appreciated that even at this organization that is nonprofit, funded by people who all hate GMOs, they all have a knee-jerk reaction against them, he's still doing the real reporting. So to me, like, that's much more important. That influences my writing. Is just, I just want to get to the truth of the matter. And like, if it's conservative, if it's Republican, if it's, you know, progressive or whatever, it doesn't matter. It's just about like, what is reality, which does exist, Dad.
Give me that microphone. What are you talking about?
For me, it's a good question, and I'm going to kind of I'm trying to go over it in my head right now. I've been an iconoclast since I can remember. I've always been a black sheep. I was a black sheep when I was 4 years old. And there was a thing on Twitter a while back where somebody asked, what's the most on-brand story from your childhood? My most on-brand story from my childhood, and I clearly remember this, is just before Columbus Day in kindergarten, I argued with the teacher because she said Columbus was the only one who thought the world was round. Everybody else thought the world. And I said, no, that's not true. Everybody, it was well known among educated people. So this is me. You know, I've always been that way. When I was in eighth grade, my insult of choice for people I did not like was conformist. And I graduated about 2 years later to cretin. But the point is that I've always been this way. I've always been anti-authoritarian. I've always been not a joiner. Not a member of groups. And even when I was forced to be in a group, I was always the troublemaker. I was always the loud mouth. So in a way, none of that has changed.
So yesterday, Maggie was driving me around Seattle, and I was complimenting her on her driving. She's a great driver. But then I noticed that she was using the GPS, but only as a map. She wasn't using the directions. She didn't want the GPS. She said, "I'm not going to let that bitch tell me where to go." And I was like, "Damn, your anti-authoritarianism is deep, honey."
Oh, yes.
You can't even have the GPS tell you what to do.
No, exactly. And in fact, computers, I am less likely to let a computer tell me what to do because they're just things. They're machines. I might as well let my dog tell me what to do. It's a machine, for goodness sake.
That was my second favorite moment driving around with you in Seattle. My first favorite moment was when a hot chick walked by and you and I both turned our heads at exactly the same time. It was kind of great.
She had a nice ass.
That's what I thought. And it was just nice to be with a woman and be able to do that. I'm just saying, you know. Okay. Matt has a question or a comment or something, or a diatribe, probably.
I'm just wondering, like, you know, you guys were talking about that guy that got beat up down in Portland. Does that affect your guys' ability, I mean, your ladies' ability to go and get the story or, you know, get sources or, like, does it affect you? I mean, it's a real threat of violence, and I saw a tweet from the Portland police that said that some of those milkshakes could have had concrete in them, and so potentially even life-threatening, so...
Yeah, so I saw that tweet as well, and I think we got to be skeptical of that narrative. I think there hasn't actually been any evidence that these milkshakes had concrete. But that said, fuck those people. Andy is not a Nazi. He's not a threat to them. And I know Andy. I highly doubt he was actually antagonizing these people. And also, like, Andy could be at the gym in Portland and somebody would run up and throw shit in his face. Like, I think he's a very, very brave person who has put himself in a terrible position and doesn't have a lot of local support in Portland. That said, I would never go to a rally like that. Good. It's also just like,
thank you.
I'm not interested in Antifa versus Proud Boys. I think they're both just like kids who want to just fuck each other up, and I don't find it interesting. So a lot of people on Twitter saying that Andy, you know, this is Andy's fault. I think that's absolute horseshit. I absolutely hate seeing journalists say this as well. But I also think it was inevitable for him in particular. Not because he's done, you know, anything to provoke violence, but because that's sort of what's going to happen. That said, that's just not my beat. Like, I avoid conflict for the most part, and I'm also not interested in that particular fight at all. But I do, like... For me, like, living in Seattle and going to... Like, I wouldn't go to a queer space in Seattle anymore. I wouldn't go to a lesbian bar or a queer bar that maybe I would have gone to a couple years ago because I just don't feel welcome. But I'm not ever worried about actual physical attacks.
Okay, I got to ask this. Okay, so this is what's bugging me. So there's a contradiction in your life, Katie, right? So you keep talking about how you...
Many, probably.
You like living in this quiet place outside of Seattle... You don't want to be bothered. You kind of want to try, but you mostly want to be left alone. You don't like fighting. You don't want to go to these rallies. What did you just say? You don't like conflict like that? But hello, your career is not... You're a provocateur.
I can't help
Every it. Every single day, you go out of your way to piss people off.
So I'm not going out of my way to do it.
Yes, you are. Hello, I'm sorry. Are you forced to go on Twitter and say shit about the left every single...
I'm speaking the truth,
Five
though.
Or six this times
is,
a day?
Yeah, but the thing is, I'm like... I'm speaking the truth. So I'm not, I do not think that I'm going out of my way to piss people off. Mm. What I'm doing is I'm speaking the truth, and the truth happens to piss people off.
I see.
I mean, I really don't like conflict. If I could like say this exact same shit and be popular and well-loved, I would fucking love it.
No, I'm there too. No, I'm totally there. I get it. I am so conflict averse that I have been known, and this is, I think partly for my first husband, who was one of those people who would argue just to argue, you know, and I'm so conflict averse now that I have been known to walk out of a place and just, nope, not talking to you anymore. Sorry. And on Twitter, of course, my mute, hair trigger mute is legendary, because as soon as you start your shit, I'm like, sorry, gone, not interested in talking to you, because the time I spend talking to you, who is an unimportant nobody. I mean, if it was, you know, some congressman or something that was arguing with me and that I thought maybe this might accomplish something, yeah, I'd swallow it and go, yeah, okay, I'm going to have this. But when it's Joe Rando with three followers? What is this going to do for me or anybody?
I do find myself, I agree with you, and I still find myself, there's some shit that I just cannot stop myself from responding to, and I just get sucked into these, like, hour-long, and I'll look at this, and I'm like, you have zero followers. Nobody can even see, there's no one to see that, like, why am I fighting with you about this stuff?
Yeah, what I do is I just mock and mute.
Yeah.
I shoot them down in flames, and then instantly mute them so I don't even have to hear their response, and people say, that's not fair, and I go, fair is a word for four-year-olds.
Yeah.
This is my life.
Yeah.
And you are not paying me to talk about this.
Totally.
And my time is all I have to sell.
Yeah. Yeah, I love the mute button. There's, I think, most of great. Seattle media is muted on my Twitter feed.
Wait. Did you answer my question, though? I don't know.
I'm full of contradictions.
Well, I mean, it's fine. I have the same contradiction. So here's how I do it. So I fight all the time, obviously, you know, on Twitter and books. You know, I'm fighting, basically. But I'm fighting people I don't know. People I care about, who I want in my life, I do avoid that kind of conflict, right? And so I will only talk about politics with people I care about if we generally agree, or if we are both open to having a real dialogue about differences. But if there's going to be a fight about politics or religion or anything else, I just won't talk about it with people I care about. Now, if it's just Joe Rando or anybody I don't care about, or especially if it's someone with institutional power, oh, it's on. It is on, and I'm going all out until I win this thing. But that's because they're not in my life, and I don't want to be around them.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I mean, it's complicated. I've lost a lot of friendships in the past few years. And more every day. It is heartbreaking, but I feel very convinced that in 10 or 20 years, I will be proven right on at least some of these positions. Okay. I don't think that's necessarily a good thing because I'm a pessimist, and so my vision of the future is not a good one, but I think that I'll be proven correct at least in some of this stuff.
Oh, definitely. You already have in some cases. Tomas.
Hi. I think there's a bit of unfinished business. There were interesting topics that were raised, and I wish we could pull the string on some more and extend them. Namely, the question of tribe versus family, because, you know, Katie described a desire to have a family, and there's push toward tribe, and where all that goes. And the other topic also I don't think we can fully discuss is this whole sort of conflation or distinction between gender and sex. You know what that is, and I wonder if you can have short comment on that.
Well, I mean, we can rewind the show. I mean, those are the two topics. So I'll just state my position on those things, I guess, if I even have one, and see where that goes. But family versus tribe. So tribe is chosen, if the queers will let me use that word. It's people I choose to assemble with, to choose to relate to, choose to be intimate with. And that's voluntary, as opposed to a family, which is, let's be honest, it's a plantation. It's slavery. The child did not ask, Katie, don't laugh at me.
You are in such big trouble.
Do not laugh at me. This is the thing. When you say radical things, you know what happens to you, right? And you don't like that. So when I say radical things, you need to... Okay. The child...
I'm just thinking of your future.
My son busted my ass, right? This was years ago. He was only like 12 or 13. I said something like, you need to do such and such, blah, 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 because I want you to, or something like that. And he was like, excuse me, you know, I didn't ask to be born, first of all. I didn't ask to be your son. I didn't ask for my mother to be my mother. I didn't ask to be born into this house, in this town, in this time. All of that... My birth, my existence, was because you wanted it. This was for you, Dad. At which point, my entire existence became meaningless. Everything was cut out from underneath me. My son became a fucking postmodernist. And I had nothing to say in response except, you know what? You're right. And there, I have zero moral... power. I can't make any moral claim on what he should or shouldn't do. If he up and leaves and goes and finds a different family or becomes a homeless circus minstrel or whatever it is, I can't say to him, Toby, you are morally obligated to stay here and be my son. No, it's a plantation. Is it not? I He can't go anywhere without my permission. If he tries to go somewhere, I will physically restrain him. If I can't physically restrain him, I can call the cops and they will physically restrain him for me. No, I wouldn't. If I, but you know this happens. If I wanted him to work, this happens in almost every family. In fact, in ours, we've made him work. How, based on what moral principle? He was born because we, my wife and I at the time, wanted a child. He had nothing to do with it, obviously. And now we're telling him he has some moral obligation because we chose to bring him into this world to please us. To please us, to please me, to satisfy my desire for a family, for a child, to fix all the wrongs in my childhood, to fix all the wrongs in her childhood. It was totally for us. So I'm busted. Yeah. Katie, back to you. Well, he is my son, so it's not, shouldn't be too surprising that he pulled the postmodernist card on me when he was 12.
Yeah, I guess I'm more interested in, I'm gonna subvert your question a little bit.
Uh-oh.
So what I'm interested in is tribe versus tribal. Because I think that while in some ways tribes are these, we are tribal, and I mean we are pack animals essentially, or we should be pack animals if you go back to sort of early humans, you know, cooperating is best for the, it's best for the individual because it's best for the whole or whatever. But then we have tribalism, which is where we see these sort of intractable, especially what's happening right now in America on the left and the right, which is a huge problem where you just say, like, the person to the left of me said this and so I agree with it, instead of looking at individual issues or letting there be any room for nuance. So I think that's really where the problem is that at the same time that we've lost our communities, our tribes, we've become more tribal in the abstract. Which I don't have a good answer for, other than people need to, like, think for them fucking selves.
Amen. I'm with you. Anyone else? Norm, last question? All right, let's do it. Last question. Then we got to go.
Question for all three of you. I'm seeing it myself. I've saw it 10 or so years ago when I was in school quite a bit. And it seems to be getting worse and worse. To the earliest conversation about freedom of expression, I see that erosion in our culture. And I think once it erodes away in our culture, it's eventually going to erode away in our courts, vis-a-vis our politicians and stuff and such, with who they appoint and who they approve in their appointments. I think all three of you are, I mean, you're all heroes in my eyes because you're helping not only various other issues, but you're helping to combat all of this. But what more can each and every one of us do in order to try to avoid that and try to continue having a society where we debate ideas and just even allow, forget even the politics of it, just allow cultural expression and individual expression that has nothing to do with power in any way, shape, or form?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think the obvious thing that we can do is also a very hard thing to do, which is to speak out when we see these principles being diminished. I think it's important for us as individuals to say something, and that's incredibly hard to do, especially if you're in a group and the wave of the group seems to be going in this one direction. It's very difficult to stand up and say, like, no, look around. But it does oftentimes, you know, sometimes it feels like all of a sudden everybody I know found Jesus, and I mean that in a bad way. You know, it's like everybody joined a cult at the same time, and I'm saying, like, guys, the building's on fucking fire, and you guys are praying about it right now. Like, it really feels that way. It feels like shouting into the void, especially in sort of monocultures like Seattle. So I think that if you are a person with balls, literal or metaphorical, fucking use them. Stand up, and, like, people need to talk about what's happening, because something is happening and it's going to get worse.
Yeah, I would very much agree with Katie on that. I think that if you believe in something, if you care about something enough to have an opinion in the first place, it should be A, your opinion, and not a borrowed opinion, not something somebody else told you to believe in, and B, it should be important enough for you to say frickin' something about. I mean, if you've got the opinion, why would you hide it? Why would you? I mean, yeah, it's easy for me to say because I'm a loudmouth, but it is the truth. I mean, all you can say is I don't want to use an expression like "speak your truth" because it sounds you know what I'm saying. But at the same time, if you don't say it, who's going to say it? Nobody can read your mind, right? It's in your head, and if you we've all had this experience, and Thad and Katie both mentioned instances of it in this very podcast, where somebody dares to say something to you, and you go, whoa, okay, let me think about that. Damn, you might be right. And even if it's just you might be right, and not you are right, it still makes a dramatic difference. It changes the world. I mean, that's the, you know, look at history, right? I mean, all the great ideas at some point started as some one person saying, hey, what about this? And other people listened and, and even if it doesn't become universal, it at least becomes, it gets out there in the marketplace of ideas. And unless you say it, it's not going to get out there. It's going to die with you.
So Katie talked about courage, right? And we know her courage, right? She has said things that have gotten her into serious trouble in her personal life, made her personally really uncomfortable, really unhappy in many, many ways, right? That's courage. Here, over here, Maggie McNeil, every single day, she does stuff that's like no one else would do, right? She lives an illegal life. She lives illicitly. And then she talks about it publicly pretty much every single day, announcing that I am doing something that's illegal and illicit, and I am considered by society to be the bottom of society, and I'm going to announce it, and I'm even going to call myself a whore, okay? So Katie talked about courage. That's courage. I just got fired from a couple jobs as a professor. Big fucking deal. A lot of people think that's courageous. Fine. But I think that Katie's got it. It starts with courage. Now, if you want to live in a better world, in a better place where there is freedom of speech or whatever it is you value, you gotta dig down somewhere. Number one. Number two, tribe. Again, what Katie's been talking about. Find your tribe. If there is no tribe, create one. Create one. That's kind of what I'm doing, trying to do here. And then, here it is. Once you find your tribe or create a tribe, you find like-minded people, you create an autonomous zone for it, right? You try to keep the authorities, the moral authorities, the legal authorities, all the authorities away from it, out of it. So this is where things like, you know, the internet come in, right? We can have conversations, we can talk, and then we can facilitate in-person meetings like the one we're having right now. No one knows this is happening. No one can stop it, really, right? So that's great, so long as the internet is free. And then something like cryptocurrency comes in, right? Where you can even have your own economy that's autonomous, that's independent. Now we're talking. Now we have a means of communication that's basically autonomous. We have even an economy, a political economy that's autonomous, right? And we can organize it in any way we want. It could be just a free market, straight up get rich economy through cryptocurrency, or a lot of these altcoins that are being created now, have social components to them. So like a portion of each transaction is taken in reserve and then used for things like social welfare, like for medical care, for unemployment insurance, for a universal basic income. This is all without government, though. This is all voluntary through cryptocurrency, right? So there, because of technology, and there's all sorts of other ways that technology is allowing us to be free and autonomous and independent from legal and moral authorities. So I think that's the big strategy here. That's the path I'm going down. I think if you want to live in a place where there is freedom of speech right now, you're going to have to create it yourself. And I think that path that I just laid out is probably, from what I can tell, the best way to do it. Make sense? Cool. So just join me, and we'll do it. And we're not gonna have any barking dogs or crying children, though, in our autonomous, virtual community. I promise you that much. I want to say no thanks to the dogs and the babies and the parents who thought it was a good idea to bring babies and dogs into a place like this.
A bar.
But I definitely want to say thank you to Maggie McNeil, our special audience member guest. Much more than that, of course. And of course, Katie Herzog, the great Katie Herzog here. Thank you so much for coming. And to all of you for coming to Renegade University Seattle. This is our first one-day event, and I thought it was a blast. and it's not even over yet. So thank you, everybody. Appreciate it. This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To get your tickets for the Unregistered live event in Brooklyn on July 16th with Nick Gillespie and Dave Smith, go to ThaddeusRussell.com.